Reprenons avec la dernière session de la journée, avec l'intervention de Luca De Biase, qui va nous parler de Who is Writing My Autobiography? Luca De Biase est journaliste pour le quotidien Diffusion nationale italien, Il Sole 24 Ore, dont il a fondé, dont il dirige la section dédiée à l'information technologique et numérique, Nova. Il tient un blog influent d'économie, de la connaissance et d'écologie des médias, et il enseigne les digital media à l'université de Padoue et à la Bocconi. Parmi ses derniers livres, je veux vous rappeler Homo Pluralis, Esseri Umani nell'era tecnologica, publié en 2015, dont il est en train de préparer une réédition, dont l'intervention de tout à l'heure reprend des éléments de la postface.
Mon français, on disait. Il y avait un professeur ici qui disait que mon français c'est comme celui d'un espagnol qui allait en Allemagne. Donc, je ne sais pas, peut-être je parle en anglais, mais si vous voulez en italien, ça serait beaucoup mieux pour moi. I'm not one of those journalists that talk about themselves. This is a paradox, like the Critias one, right? I'm not a journalist that talks about himself. It's a paradox. But I'm using this paradox to talk about this idea of the possibility of autobiography today. And this is the question, because it used to be that a good life is a life that you can talk about, that you can tell. If there is here in Paris Antoine Compagnon, who teaches literature at the Collège de France, who I love, and he spoke, he gave 3 or 4 courses about biography and autobiography, and he was talking about the idea of the possibility of biography and all this stuff. But the real thing was to ask if somebody's life needs to be told about, to be a good life, an interesting life, a life that has merit. So am I the author of my life is the question in the context that we are talking about. And of course, I just have to say that this is just a research idea and that I'm doing this in the perspective of the media ecology approach. And the second thing that we need to agree about is this idea of the total digitalization of knowledge that has already happened. In terms of what Martin Hilbert does, he says that while in the year 2000 we had 25% of total human knowledge recorded in 1 year on digital format, now it is almost all knowledge that is recorded in digital format. This means that the digitalization of the environment, of the perception of the world, of the knowledge that we produce, has already been digitized, which is the past. About the future, and we are here, our autobiography is always in the present, which is a link, let's say, between the past and the future. The future is a big deal. I mean, shift happens. I don't know if you smile about this joke, but it's a big deal. I mean, it's just to talk for one concept that there is here, biotechnology is studying gene editing. All of these things, of course, start from the digital environment that we already have made all of these special innovations or domains of research are made by digital computing and all that stuff. None of these could be possible without the computer and data and everything. In the biotechnology, we're talking about gene editing. Edit the genome. And this is made very easy and cheap, at least much more cheaper and easier. I'm not able to do it, but many scientists are able to edit the gene thanks to this new technology that is called CRISPR-Cas9, which is has been invented in 2011. 2012 has been published on Nature, and in the 3 years after that, it generated hundreds of startups, billions of investments, and an idea of the possibility to change easily and cheaply the genome of everything. Of course, people is talking about new crops for agriculture, for textile, but it's clear that we can change the human body. And it was decided by the one of the scientists that invented the CRISPR-Cas9. She's called Jennifer Doudna, with the DNA in the name. That's incredible. And she asked for everybody to think about what we are doing with CRISPR-Cas9 to the human body. And she called a conference of all geneticists in Washington in December last year to call for a moratorium. Let's voluntarily abstain to edit the human body until we understand better what are the consequences of this. And they discussed for 1 week about this, and they decided no, they will edit the human body. The major motivation was that if we don't do this, somebody else will do this, which was, an idea of the way things happen. But the fact is that the major scientist that wanted not to stop the use in human body was his George Church. He said that somebody else would do it if we don't do it. And he also lectured about what we can do on human bodies right now. And he said it's very easy to change the form of the eye. It's quite easy to change the color of the eye. It's not easy yet to add features that we like in animals on the human body. So this kind of stuff is discussed. And it is discussed in the environment in which we live, that is digitized, with the kind of information systems that we have, with the kind of debating system that we use. And of course, this is something to discuss. We had about 50 years of discussion on climate change and environmental stuff, and we just arrived to have some kind of sort of beginning of accord. Well, CRISPR-Cas9 should be dealt with soon. But who will do that? Which biographies will do that? Am I the author of my life? One of the persons that made me think this kind of question was Steve Jobs, who at the commencement speech, which was very much quoted, also said, your time to the students. He said to them, your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Be the author of your life. If you write the screenplay of your life, then you're free, and that is a good life. If you don't, somebody else will write your life, and that will be a life that was wasted. That was the idea. And he also brought to us this guy, which is the major thing that makes us question the idea of being really the author of our autobiography. Because it comes from the idea of Steve Jobs that the computer is the bicycle of the mind. Of course, this one didn't trust very much about the bicycle not being robbed, but the bicycle of the mind was a metaphor that Steve Jobs used in 1980 to explain what he had in mind for the future of Apple. And 1980, he was famous because of Apple II. Macintosh didn't happen yet. It was in 94. And the PC, the IBM PC, was due to come out in 81. So he explained what he saw in the future. And he explained it saying this. I just saw an article in Popular Science that made a ranking of animals in terms of their energy efficiency. On top, the condor is the animal that does 1 kilometer using less energy. And the human was low in the ranking. We use a lot of energy for doing 1 kilometer. But the human with the bicycle, on the bicycle, is better than the condor. And that's what I want to tell you. The computer is like a bicycle for the mind. And of course, this is after the Macintosh in 2007. It came out the iPhone, and the iPhone is even better than a bike. It's a prosthesis. We have this wonderful drawing for this conversation. It's part of the human anatomy, has said the Supreme Court. Supreme Court has debated a case in which a citizen was protesting against the police because police had searched his smartphone. And it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that the citizen is right, and the police shouldn't search the telephone. And they explained it with these magical words. I think to our constitutional judges, they don't use this kind of language. In the Supreme Court in America, they use a language that I understand. And they said, the police shouldn't search the telephone because it's the telephone, it's special thing. If somebody comes from Mars and look at us, thinks that the telephone is part of human anatomy. So that was interesting. But as being part of human anatomy means that if I use my anatomy to write my own autobiography, my anatomy has changed in ways that I'm writing my autobiography but when I want to write it, and also when I don't want, and also when I don't know that I'm writing my autobiography. And somebody else is writing my autobiography in a way. because the phone has changed my body and the environment in which I live, and this is for Maurizio, the recording machine, the mobilizing machine, the obligations that I have because I'm mobilized are enhanced by recording machines, or become the relationship towards which my obligations develop. Is it possible that the human machine compact becomes something with which I relate and towards which I have obligations? I don't know. And that's why I show you this photograph. That doesn't mean anything to the thing that I'm talking about, but I like it. It's, you see, this is a robot. He's not a trolley with that you bring about. This is a robot that follows the guy everywhere he goes. So it has sensors. It has the map. It's linked to the person that goes everywhere. In Naples would be fantastic to rob. And also it's done by an Israeli startup, so I'm sure that those Napolitan would be punished because of what they think they can do. This also means something on the body. This is the next generation of virtual reality thing, and you feel not only with the eyes but with all body. And this is the next generation, next generation of vehicle, commercial vehicle. It goes to without driver to near the shop, and the drones that it has on top take the package and bring it to the shop. This is the same thing, but it makes me think that autobiography is discussed correctly in our age. This guy has been used to kill the person that was shooting the policeman in Dallas because one of the killers was too well defended in a position that was not police was not able to get him. So they send this drone, this robot, and this one killed him. Who shoot? Who was the guy that killed the person? This one is also interesting, and it's a fact, and also it's a metaphor. The fact is that Joshua Brown was not driving his Tesla when he died. Joshua Brown was well known because he didn't drive his own Tesla, and he took pictures and movies and videos of what happened. And he was very excited while taking these videos, because the Tesla was so intelligent, it did what he wanted, and also there was a case, and the video shows that the truck was cutting his line, and the Tesla was able to stop a little bit, so they didn't collide, and he was excited talking about this thing, and some days later, the Tesla was not able to see another truck, and they crashed, and he died. And he's the first person that died while not driving a self-driving car. Who was driving? What autobiography? What biography is this? Who is doing this? These are questions, and it's fantastic to be a journalist because you ask questions. That's what you do. These our questions are less questions than the philosopher's questions, but are questions as well. And so we ask, who is driving this one? Who is writing Facebook? You are familiar with the Facebook experiment 3 years ago. Yes, everybody. So that was a demonstration, not, of course, of priming. It was a demonstration of the fact that the algorithm is able to change the mood of 1,700,000,000 people when they want. Who's writing? Who is doing this stuff? It's a question. I'm myself doing things, but I'm also something else that is an extension of my body due to this prosthesis that we have. This happens because of persuasive interfaces. We have seen some thought about that before, secret algorithms. You already have talked about that today, and of course JC was much on the line at the beginning, and unequal control of data. The fog model is very important to understand technologies that can be persuasive, and everybody that designs a new technology knows this, and they want to do this. So it must be easy to use in relationship with the motivation that you have, and also it has to tell you that you must use it now. That's very interesting. They know how to do this, and they do it. And so technologies become part of our habit, or it's clear. So the thing is that designers, and this part from here on, it's really research. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just trying to understand something and maybe ask questions to you. But it's clear that when they design this persuasive thing, that has motivations, that implies some abilities, some skills, and that implies some hypotheses on human behavior that tells them that this thing will make people use the technology right now, like the like in Facebook. The target behavior is like, it's perfect. Then they also have values. And those values, their values, are embedded in the platform, in the things that they do. This book is a collection of cases in which the values of designers embedded in the technologies have consequences that we don't know about because we don't know the algorithms that make those technologies work, which is very interesting in terms of my autobiography. I don't know. It is secret, the working of the thing that makes me write my autobiography. Who am I now? Catherine Taylor's story, it's a story that I found in this book, but it was found out by a survey of by the Washington Post. Catherine Taylor one day was not able anymore to have some money from the bank and to find a job and to find a flat, an apartment. Because she found out that in the credit score, somehow appeared the notion of she having been accused of amphetamine traffic. So she was not able to find a job anymore because her biography was written by an algorithm that she didn't know how it worked and how he got that kind of information. But that kind of information she challenged, it was fake. She succeeded in taking off from choice point that fake information, but choice point had already sold the information to other score things, reputational things, that already had understood this kind of thing, and she was not able to leave for 4 years. And after 4 years, she was able to have a new job, but still not a new apartment. I quote this also because of the title. You understand that I love good titles. Weapons of Math Destruction is good. This is ProPublica that is doing a series of surveys right now. This is the second one. ProPublica has found this algorithm that changes the price of things in relationship with the zip code of consumers. So if the zip code is for an environment of rich people, then you have a price that is higher than the one that you charge to people that are less rich. For the same thing, with the same page, but the page online is generated by an algorithm that recognizes the person and gives a different information. And this is mind-blowing, to have such an ability to change the price for things. We were not in this kind of world 10 years ago. And this is really difficult to understand because of the speed of the change that's happening. And most people is not able to understand this. Also, there are racial bias in algorithm. They found that there are black people are more likely to be thought possible criminals by algorithms that are used by police and other things. My time is running out, so I'll go right away to the end of the story. All these things are useful to understand the kind of challenge these future technologies propose to us. And I guess that if we want to look at the future, we need to know that the economist has said that economics is the science that studies why its predictions didn't work. But there is not much better things to do to understand the future. One other suggestion is from the Institute for the Future that I like very much. There are no facts in the future, so you don't forecast the future because there are no facts of the future to study. There are narratives. And this leads to the conclusion of what I want to say, because narratives are a sort of organized set of values that are recognizable in the design of the technologies that we see coming. And these kind of narratives are many, of course, and have a story. I would just discuss, mention three of them: the finance narrative, technology narrative, and ecology narrative. Finance is the most important for many reasons in terms of financing new technologies. It has a lot of consequences, and the narrative of finance is what gains, what works in terms of profits, is the right thing to do. technology is about what works is the right thing to do. Ecology narratives is about what evolves is the thing that happens. And evolution is the question mark. It's something that we are trying to understand since Darwin, and it works to use evolution in the media ecology context with a lot of consequences, because it helps to understand that info diversity is good. It helps to understand that sort of equilibrium of power is good. And it helps in terms of understanding that my individual choice, decision, is important for the whole thing. And the whole thing, the quality of the whole thing, is very important for me as an individual. This kind of a notion that comes from the ecological movement that has 50 years of story can be useful also as a narrative for looking at the future of technologies that we discussed until now. Thank you, and questions.
Merci beaucoup, Luca De Biase, pour ton intervention. On a quelques minutes pour des questions. On peut faire un tour de table de questions. En attendant la première question, j'en profiterai pour te demander ce que tu penses de la catégorie de sujet dans le cadre de la question de la motivation. Parce que est-ce qu'en proposant une approche écologique à l'action, il faut revoir cette notion de sujet, ou est-ce qu'on peut continuer à poser la question avec le who, comme tu le faisais dans la présentation?
Le sujet est la personne qui fait les choses parce qu'elle est libre de le faire. Autonome et singulière. Ça n'existe pas. Mais n'existe aussi, ça n'existe pas aussi le collectif. C'est pour ça que j'essaie de réfléchir sur la notion de pluriel. Moi, je suis en même temps beaucoup de dimension, c'est pas seulement moi, c'est Jacques Le Goff qui enseignait là, dans la maison. À la maison, j'ai commencé avec Fernand Braudel il y a beaucoup de temps. Il y avait aussi Jacques Le Goff. Jacques Le Goff, il avait fait la biographie de Saint-Louis, lui. Il a discuté longtemps sur la notion d'individu, qui a une histoire. Il n'y avait pas l'individu il y a 300 années.
Peut-être que tu peux nous dire aussi comment ça s'articule avec ton projet en cours, avec l'épistémologue Telmo Pievani, sur les métaphores, sur comment ces métaphores évolutionnistes s'appliquent en contexte numérique.
Mais je te remercie de poser la question. Donc, l'idée, c'est que l'évolutionnisme, l'approche évolutionniste a une histoire, lui aussi. Et il est assez utilisé dans le domaine de la technologie. En fait, l'idée d'écosystème de l'innovation, c'est une idée qui a très grand succès. L'idée de la sélection de plus adapté, c'est très utilisé dans la technologie. Mais les métaphores qui sont utilisées pour expliquer la technologie sont un petit peu vieux. Avec Telmo Pievani, on a étudié l'application, l'adaptation de métaphores de l'approche évolutionniste à la technologie en utilisant notions qui sont contemporaines de l'évolutionnisme. Par exemple, la notion de niche éco-culturelle, qui explique comment la technologie et l'humain sont la même chose. La technologie, c'est une expression de l'humain. Le fait, c'est que l'humain crée sa propre niche dans laquelle évolue et coévolve avec la technologie. Et en créant la niche écoculturelle, limite son propre développement. Jusqu'à quand une nouvelle progression de la technologie ou de la solution qu'on fait, crée une nouvelle niche écoculturelle. Mais la chose intéressante de cela, c'est de critiquer l'idée qu'il y a, mais ça a été déjà dit, d'une part l'humain et de l'autre part la technique, c'est parti à plein droit de l'humain.
Thank you very much. It was a beautiful talk with a huge canvas. I'm particularly interested in this idea that values are embedded in technology. Now, values have always been involved in the technology platform. We talked about how many people were likely to die from cars made in Detroit with and without certain things. People have been aware for some time of massive effects of apparently localized small decisions, and a lot of utilitarian thinking about value has gone on. But it seemed to me that the force of what you're saying is that values are embedded in this new world of technology to a different degree or in a different way, or is it the rapidity? I just wanted to invite you to say something more about that, because I think that's a very interesting kind of an idea, that maybe at this point in the development of industrialization, when the machines make the machines and we make the machines that can make the machines and so on, somehow our talk about values being embedded in technology is much more continuous, much more fraught, and always framed against a backdrop of ignorance in a certain way about the implications of what we do. So for me, this is very interesting what you're saying. And the dichotomy, again, between facts and values is not a dichotomy, even though it has to be a distinction we can draw in certain local contexts. So I wonder if you could say more about that. It's an important.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. That's my question. I would like very much to develop on that. One thing that we need to challenge is that there is an objective data environment in which reality happens, and then we need to understand it. And also, as a consequence, we need to challenge the idea that there is a reality, and then we need to do something to change it, as if we knew the interpretation of reality as different from being into the reality. Being into the reality changes the reality. Understanding something of the reality changes the reality, and we are in the middle of that kind of process. That's the chaotic part of an ecosystem. That doesn't mean that we cannot do anything. It doesn't mean also that we cannot rely on one particular thing to make the whole system work as we want. So these are the two or three things that is our reaction to that. My idea of a narrative is that this can be discussed more easily. So we can do more about that. Because reality is an enabler of innovations that have that kind of approach, that kind of values. If we challenge the monomaniac financial narrative, that is already something that makes some of the innovations that come out after that different. I think. I'm not sure. I'm just discussing about this. If I challenge the idea that technology goes as it need to go because technology has its own technological logic and resistance is futile, that kind of thinking is such that we are not responsible anymore. We just wait for the next version that will be better than the one we have now to solve problems, which is not true. So, in the chaotic thing that we are talking about, and which has no easy solution because it's not linear, and that's the fact, the reality that we face, humans always have relied on stories to understand things. If they know they are stories, if they know that those are simple ideas of complexity that help act with a direction, that is something, the narrative, that can have consequences. I saw that with the ecology about the environment. In environment, I was born in Italy when we were in the industrialization boom. We were a country with 60% of people working in agriculture after the war, and in 20 years, those people were 5%. And the rest went to work for an industry. So industrialization was the story, the linear story that brought everybody towards a future in which children would be better off than parents. I was worried about pollution. I was young and I was a freak. I was different. I was few. Nobody was thinking about pollution. We were thinking about car, holidays, children at school, toilets at home, all these things that we didn't have before and that were very good. Hospitals, material welfare. Pollution was an external bad thing that we could think later. After 50 years, we think that externalities are not externalities anymore. They are part of the economic system, industrial system, and we want an industrial system that thinks that pollution is not an externality to think about later. It's part of now. This change has happened, and it was a narrative that made that change. It was not any other different thing. It was disaster Chernobyl. It was the disaster in Three Mile Island. It was the fact that industrialization was not growing at the same speed in Western countries as before. But it was also a narrative that made us think that my small individual gesture is important for the quality of the environment, and the quality of the environment is very important for the quality of my life. That kind of thing is a narrative, is not nothing else than a narrative. And it has consequences on the very design of all ways to produce that we use now. When we design a new factory, we design it with that kind of narrative in mind. Of course, we can have the financial narrative in the same moment, and that will make robots that take away the job to humans. This is one of the questions of today. In financial narrative, capital wants to have machines. It's much better than humans because they make more profit. For an Italian, that is nonsense. We have humans that create value for things. And so our robots are made to augment the productivity of people. So that in Italy, I heard a person saying that of course we are better because the Americans do RoboCop. We do RoboCop.